And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to the second hour of this week's Mike Cannon Show. Due to time constraints, there'll be no third hour this week. So if you're listening to 93.3 WNRB LP in Wausau, and if it is Monday, these 2 hours will be looped back again today. Up next, a show I try to bring you each and every week about this time. This Way Out is an LGBT news magazine produced out of San Francisco. After that will be P-Call Check-In, Gardening with Lisa the Waitress segment, Black Agenda Radio, that's this hour's lineup. And that's the type of alternative programming you get each and every week here on the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to be informed from alternative non-business voices from the non-corporate wilderness. Thanks for listening.
You're just in time. Enjoy the show.
Let me love you. Let me say that I do.
Black and white. Why does the world want to be black and white?
You are not alone in this fight. Take a stand for equality and fight for your right.
Here's the deal, sissy. GW has been pressuring me to do something I don't want to do, sexually.
Oh, sweet baby Jesus.
I certainly did not need to know that.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Stockholm homophobes prey on Europride participants. Political hip-hop, comfortable rock, and dreamy jazz pop in the audiophile. And a sordid small-town saga parks its trailer on the logo lot. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 2nd, 2008. Violent attacks against four gay men and the homophobic vandalism of three Lutheran churches marred the celebration of Europride in Stockholm this week. The 10-day festival in the Swedish capital, held in a different city each year and capped by the traditional Pride Parade, has attracted tens of thousands of LGBT visitors from across Europe. But two gay men in their late 20s were robbed and stabbed earlier in the week. According to police officials, the couple had just shared a kiss outside a convenience store when two men yelling homophobic slurs assaulted them, took their cell phones, stabbed one in the stomach, and then stabbed the other as he tried to protect his partner. They're each reportedly in serious condition, and the assailants have thus far eluded capture. Two other men were beaten in the city as their attacker shouted anti-gay slurs and specifically denounced Europride. Neither of the victims was seriously injured. Three young men, aged 17 to 20, were arrested a short time later and charged with assault as a hate crime. Three Lutheran churches in Stockholm were also vandalized this week. Authorities said the churches had flyers pasted over the facades of the buildings denouncing Europride and containing biblical condemnations of homosexuality. Anti-queer literature from a group calling themselves Orthodox Christians was scattered around the grounds at each location. The Swedish Lutheran Church, the largest denomination in the country, is lesbi-gay welcoming and has a booth at Europride.
The man who shot and killed two people and wounded seven others at a church in the U.S. state of Tennessee this week reportedly hated liberals and gay people. 58-year-old Jim D. Adkison allegedly targeted the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church because of its liberal reputation. He burst into Sunday services as parish children were performing for the congregation, opening fire with a 12-gauge shotgun he'd hidden in a guitar case. Knoxville Police Chief Sterling P. Owen IV told reporters that a four-page letter found in Adkison's car indicated that the attack was motivated by his frustration over not being able to find a job, for which he blamed gays and what he called the liberal movement. The Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church is like most others in the denomination, with a long record of activism in social justice movements. The church makes its space available for weekly meetings of a local chapter of parents, families, and friends of lesbians and gays, and the predominantly LGBT Metropolitan Community Church of Knoxville held services there during the first 8 years of its existence. Adkison has been charged with first-degree murder and is being held on $1 million bail.
Religious police in Saudi Arabia Acting on a tip received by the State Commission for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, raided another so-called gay party this week. Local television reported that two young men wearing women's makeup and dancing together were among 55 people arrested in the eastern coastal province of Qatif. Drugs and alcohol were reportedly also found, and many of those arrested were apparently young Filipino and Pakistani men living in the country on work permits. More than 20 men were arrested during a similar raid, also in Qatif, in June. Homosexuality is severely punished in Saudi Arabia under Sharia or Islamic law. Convictions can even lead to public beheadings. A court in April 2006 sentenced two Saudis, one Yemeni and a Jordanian, to 2,000 lashes and 2 years in prison after a similar raid on an allegedly gay party.
Bahrain's parliament passed a measure in April ordering the Gulf state's interior ministry to stop granting residence permits to foreign homosexuals, and an MP this week demanded that the government begin implementing that law. The measure called for gay men to be rooted out of hair salons and massage parlors, and that teachers watch for homosexual tendencies in children and punish them accordingly. Up to 2,000 allegedly gay Filipino workers may have been deported in 2002 by the predominantly Muslim nation.
An Ugandan AIDS activist was abducted and tortured by police this week, according to reports by Human Rights Watch, Sexual Minorities Uganda, and the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC. Usam Mukwaya and two other activists were charged with trespassing in June after staging a protest during a global HIV-AIDS conference in Kampala to demand that men who have sex with men be included in the deliberations. According to an IGLHRC press release, after he was abducted, Mukwaya was cut around the hands and tortured with a machine that applies extreme pressure to the body, preventing breathing and causing severe pain, and that he was aggressively questioned about the Ugandan LGBT movement. Mukwaya was reportedly dumped by the side of the road after the interrogation, and members of Sexual Minorities Uganda found him weak, filthy, and without shoes in some of his clothing. Human Rights Watch warned that the abduction and torture of an Ugandan HIV-AIDS activist who faces trial for holding a peaceful protest reveals the danger to those who challenge the government's policies. Police officials insist that Mukwaya was not harmed during detention and was simply seeking publicity. Consenting adult same-gender sex is outlawed in Uganda, and President Yoweri Museveni has often railed against homosexuality as a negative foreign culture.
U.S. President George W. Bush signed legislation this week that repealed a law banning HIV-positive travelers or immigrants from entering the country. The measure passed both houses of Congress by significant margins as part of a global HIV-AIDS funding bill. The ban was created by a 1987 regulation that added HIV to the list of communicable diseases that bar visitors and immigrants. But the Health and Human Services Department must implement the new regulation by issuing a notice in the Federal Register where rule changes are published. A mandatory comment period of up to 90 days follows, and only then can the rule be finalized. Writing in the New York-based Gay Community News this week, Duncan Osborne reported that a memo issued to all federal agencies on May 9th by White House Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton specified that any new regulations for the remainder of the Bush administration had to be proposed by June 1st and finalized by November 1st. Bolton wrote that the only exceptions were for extraordinary circumstances. It appears, then, that repeal of the HIV travel and immigration ban may not take effect until there's a new president in the White House.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick signed legislation on July 31st repealing a 1913 law that barred couples from marrying there if the union would not be valid in their home states. Following a previous Senate vote, the House overwhelmingly voted for repeal earlier in the week. California, which in June became the only other U.S. state with marriage equality, has no residency requirement. Same-gender weddings have been legal in Massachusetts since 2004, and repeal of the 1913 law, originally enacted to bar interracial marriage, now allows couples from other states to marry there. Opponents of repeal warned that the move would make Massachusetts the Las Vegas of gay marriage and would infringe on other states' rights to define marriage. But supporters said that the old law had racist origins and argued that repeal would bring an economic boom to Massachusetts. A recent study, in fact, predicted that same-gender couples marrying there, especially from nearby states, would add $111 million to the Massachusetts economy in the next 3 years. Several out-of-state lesbi-gay couples have already requested marriage license applications in Provincetown, according to Assistant Town Clerk Susie Fultz, and more are expected. New York doesn't allow its same-gender couples to marry, but, citing several court rulings, Governor David Paterson has ordered the state to recognize such marriages legally performed elsewhere.
Marriage equality in California is far from secure, of course, with a looming November ballot initiative, Proposition 8, that would overturn the state Supreme Court ruling and constitutionally ban same-gender marriage. That hasn't stopped thousands of couples from getting marriage licenses in California since the court ruling took effect in mid-June. The original wording of the ballot initiative read, "Amends the California Constitution to provide that only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California." But new language, ordered by State Attorney General Jerry Brown this week, will now say that the initiative changes California Constitution to eliminate right of same-sex couples to marry. It also notes that banning those marriages could prevent California from gaining tens of millions of dollars in potential sales tax revenue. Supporters of Proposition 8 say they're considering a lawsuit demanding that the language appear as it did on petitions that qualified the initiative for the ballot. Jennifer Kearns, spokeswoman for the so-called Protect Marriage Coalition, said that the new language could prejudice voters against the initiative. But Steve Smith, campaign manager for No on Proposition 8, applauded the language change. "What Proposition 8 would do is eliminate the right of same-sex couples to marry," he said, "which is exactly what the Attorney General put in the title of the measure."
And finally, Florida and Arizona are also facing November ballot initiatives to constitutionally ban same-gender marriage. But Barbara McCullough-Jones of Equality Arizona is concerned that all the attention and money are going to the California battle. "We need a win in California. We need a win in Florida. We need a win in Arizona," she wrote in an article published this week. That very trifecta has the potential to change the face of American politics.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 2, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
Just who has real family values and whose lives are sordid? We'll head down south for the answers to that question later in the program. Hip-hop that's not straight, folk rock that's also country, and a dangerous dream come true jazz up this edition of The Audiophile.
The new album by hip-hop artist Milaj Lavon is called The Movement. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. This album definitely shows that she is very talented and very political.
Dear Mr. President,
the nation from just one dude. Got a lot to repair, America's right here. We all waiting for you to lead us through. We gotta get back, yeah, on the right track. What's the blueprint of your next move?
You'll also find in her album that hip-hop is a genre not reserved for straight topics.
The album covers a lot of issues like gay bashing, global warming, gay parenting, domestic violence within the gay community, future president, gay marriage, and very proud of this album because it's a lot of issues that need to be addressed.
So I gotta be strong, now I got my reason to stand up for people like Jeff who stop grieving, cause I'm there with you every step of the way. You ain't gotta be afraid of what society say, cause I've been there before. The lowest point in my life, consider suicide a feeling that I wanted to die, but I survived and you are not alone in this fight. Take a stand for equality and fight for your right. You ain't a Christian, you go and preach hate. Hey, you call yourself a church, together you congregate. Yay, turn around and point the finger, discriminate. Yay.
To find out more about Melange Lavon and her album, The Movement, we'll help you out with the spelling. Her site is at www.melangelavonne.com.
Black and white, how can the world be black and white? 'Cause when I look out in the night, I see a thousand shades of gray. Black and white, why does the world want to be black and white? It makes me sad and I know it's not right for all the world to be that way.
The debut album by Maury Campbell is called Long Way Home. And with it, at least I feel like I'm in this warm and comfortable place, like I'm with an old friend.
There's a wide variety of musical styles. I got stripped down vocal acoustic guitar tracks. I have tracks with the full band. And I go from folk to rock country. And I think people will really enjoy the listen.
Whatever I can see, my miss of diamonds up my sleeve. And I don't need to see how it ends. I can make whatever I can see, my miss of diamonds.
You can learn more about Maury Campbell and his album, Long Way Home, at www.mauryc.com. That's www.morryc.com.
Let me love you. Let me say that I do. If you lend me your ear, I'll make it clear the ways that I do. Let me whisper it. Let me sigh it. Let me sing it, my dear, or I will cry it.
Suede is back, and this time with a big band, for her first album in 7 years.
Oh, I'm thrilled about it. It's called Dangerous Mood, which I named appropriately for my 25th anniversary of making my whole living with music, which has certainly been dangerous and thrilling. And it's recorded with a 14-piece big band, which is a childhood dream of mine. So I'm just thrilled to get it out to the world, and I hope everybody loves it.
We could go the distance and find us romance. I like your persistence, your style and your stance. There's only one problem, the tiniest problem. I like to lead when I dance.
Find out more about Dangerous Mood, the latest CD by Suede, at www.suedewave.com. That's www.suedewave.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at our new address, 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas, 77380, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
I like to lead when I dance.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Our Steve Fry gets in touch with his southern roots and sets a spell with the folk behind the new Logo TV hit, Sordid Lives, the series. Creator, writer, director Del Shores and his producer, star husband, Jason Dotley.
Last week on Laundry Day, a red sock found its way into a load of white stuff, and now I sleep on pink sheets. So it's no surprise to me that Sordid Lives, a TV show about a white trash family in a redneck town, just debuted on Logo, the country's pinkest network.
I did not need to know that.
Or that this summer, fans of playwright Del Shores are happier than a fat tick on a skinny dog.
I certainly did not need to know that.
This prequel to the cult classic film,
Off and Running,
is about a small town Texas family, presided over by Peggy Ingram, played by Rue McClanahan, whose beloved brother boy, played by Leslie Jordan, is a Tammy Wynette impersonator living in a state mental hospital.
I'm Dr. Eve, when you dehomosexualize me, will I still be able to perform as Tammy Wynette?
Peggy's good-time daughter, Lavonda, lives with Peggy's sister, Sissy, a chain-smoking caretaker who doles out the family Valium.
Well, thank goodness I've got another bottle in the medicine cabinet.
Bonnie Belinda plays Peggy's uptight and controlling daughter, Latrell.
There's a new therapist over at the institution, Dr. Eve Bollinger, who thinks she can dehomosexualize brother boy.
I was watching Jenny Jones here a while back, and they were saying homosexuality is not a choice.
Sissy, that is not the point.
Well, it seems like it would be the point in this, for instance.
Lavonda's best friend, Nolita, played by Carolyn Ray, lives in Sissy's backyard in a trailer with her crippled husband, G.W.
Here's the deal, Sissy. G.W. has been pressuring me to do something I don't want to do sexually.
Oh, sweet baby Jesus.
He wants to make love to me without them legs on.
Why me, Lord? Why?
The adorable Jason Dotley plays Latrell's son, Ty, a struggling L.A. actor who's also struggling with his sexuality.
Okay, that's it. I'm out of here.
Fine, leave. But maybe it's time you learn compassion for others instead of being like every other actor and homosexual in this vapid town. All about me, me, me.
I thought therapy was supposed to be about me. And I am here because I am not sure that I am a homosexual.
Oh, trust me, honey. You are a big old queer.
Throw in Olivia Newton-John as Bitsy Mae Harling, a bisexual bar singer fresh out of prison, with cameos from Margaret Cho, Carson Kressley, and Candace Kane as Ty's therapists. And all I can say is, if it were any better, I'd have to hire someone to help me enjoy it.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Del Shores. I am a writer and producer and director, and my series, Sordid Lives, just started airing on Logo.
Hi, I'm Jason Dotley. I am the adorable new guy in Sordid Lives, the series.
How autobiographical is this?
With Sordid Lives, I am basically Ty, the character of Ty and Latrell. That's a relationship with my mom, and I basically just lifted my therapy sessions. The one great thing about my mom, and when she passed away, I found all of these files where she had done so much research on my behalf about gay. She really wanted to be informed, and I wish that other people in my family would do that, because she wanted to know what it was about, and asking way too many questions. You know, the first time I go home, it's like Christmas. I bring my daughters, they're 2 and 5 at the time, and my mother comes into my bedroom, and she says, I need to ask you some questions. And I go, oh, okay. And she goes, what is it exactly that you do? And I'm like, what? And you know, she goes, you know, gay stuff. What do you do? And I'm like, oh my God, mother, I am not going to talk to you about this. There are books you can read. And then so finally she just kept on, and I thought, okay, you know what? So I just basically looked at my lap and started explaining a lot of things. I left some things out, but that was the kind of mom she was. And then there's that long pause. She goes, well, are you the woman or the man? Mother, I'm a gay man. We don't... Anyway.
While the character he plays on the Sordid Lives TV series is confused about his sexuality, Jason Dotley is not. And he wants you to know.
I think that the reason so many straight actors are playing gay is that most gay actors won't play gay. And it's very frustrating to me as a gay man, because I see it as a form of internalized homophobia, and I don't know if it's being reinforced from their families or from their representatives or agents, But regardless, it's really sort of an annoying attribute that many of my fellow gay actors share, and I wish they'd all get over it.
When did you know you were gay?
I came out in my 10th grade year of high school to my mom and all of my friends, and I took it as the greatest difference in the world. It was such an empowering thing for me to be so different than everybody else, and I really embraced that. And I started my high school's Gay Straight Alliance in Spring Hill, Florida, which was very successful. Someone asked me the other day in an interview about being gay and being out, etc. And I said, why would you want to be so successful and live in a cage? Why?
Not only is Jason Dotley the leading man in Sordid Lives, the series, he's Del Shore's leading man at home.
We were married in October of 2003, October 26th, on the beach of Malibu. And now we have just applied for our marriage license to be legally married in the state of California.
And I think that Newell Alexander, who plays Wardell, who more interestingly is Del's former father-in-law, is going to be presiding over our nuptials.
What do you want the audience to take away from the show?
I want people to be able to laugh during this not-so-great period in American history. And if for 30 minutes a week, if people can just forget that outside world and laugh and feel with these characters, then that was my intention for this, because it is very funny, but it is often touching. The Republicans, they're always talking about family values, and yet they continue to knock my family through their constitutional amendments and spewing hatred, basically, from pulpits and political forums. So I feel like that I'm giving people something to embrace. It's a quirky family, but basically the series is about love and acceptance and family and our values.
And I like it that young gay people have someone to see on television that they can relate to. I didn't have that as a kid. I had, you know, Rupert Everett and Madonna as, you know, two prominent gay men in my stratosphere.
I love the way you call Madonna a gay man.
Well, like, come on. She's kind of as close as you can get.
This has been a visit with Del Shores and Jason Dotley. Sordid Lives, the series, airs on the U.S. cable network Logo. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Why should I care what they whisper about me? I tell the truth, but still they'll doubt me. Been misunderstood for all of my life. Even when I've been good, they think it's a lie. That's why it's none of my business what you think of me. I ain't never been perfect and I ain't gonna be. I know who I am and it ain't what you see.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, Pam Marshall, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Melange Lavant, Maury Campbell, Suede, and Olivia Newton-John performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are funded by charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to help. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038 USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, WRNC Ashland, Wisconsin, KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
We need to stop using the word democracy to describe the every 2 or 4 year exercise to fill electoral offices in the United States. The ritual is in fact a commercial enterprise, utterly dominated by corporations that control not only which individuals are nominated by the two big business parties, but what ideas and political programs are made visible to the public. Citizens cannot possibly make free and informed choices when the only views to which they have access are those fed to them by the giant communications corporations that monopolize the American political conversation. When money and the rich man's media are the supreme arbiters of which ideas, parties, and candidates are permitted to effectively compete in the public arena, then democracy does not exist. In Washington, D.C., the statehood Green Party, through labor-intensive, grassroots work, has managed to garner more votes in the last several elections than the local Republican Party. That's an amazing accomplishment, given that the statehood Greens get virtually no coverage from the Washington Post newspaper, which means little or no exposure in the corporate television media either, since all the stations follow the Post's lead. Let's go over the facts again. The statehood Greens are the number 2 party in Washington, D.C., yet the Washington Post refuses to cover them. The paper's congressional reporter, Paul Kane, recently slipped up and told the brutally honest truth about the Post's methodical manipulation of the news. Kane claimed the Greens and Ralph Nader got plenty of coverage in the 2000 election when, in his words, Nader had a chance to play a decisive role in some states. According to Kane, there is little indication that the Greens will have any major impact on the 2008 election. Then, Kane declared, and I quote him, "Until you, Greens, demonstrate that there is some level of support for your party, our paper isn't going to spend precious resources reporting on whatever it is you're doing." Kane is a corporate hack who arrogantly refuses to be bothered finding out just what precisely the Greens are doing, nationally or locally. It appears that's not part of his job description as a major media journalist. The Washington Post won't even cover the Greens in D.C., where they are second to the Democrats in voter appeal. And this year, there are at least as many swing states where the Greens and Ralph Nader's independent operation can play as decisive a role as in the 2000 election, if that is really the criteria for coverage. In reality, the Washington Post and the rest of the corporate media cabal withhold coverage from the non-big business parties in order to starve the public of alternative choices and ideas. They are censors who, as Green Party national standard bearers Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente have said, are attempting to white out a political party that just nominated 2 women of color for president and vice president. Giant corporations control the political menu in the United States. The public is given little choice but to consume whatever the moneyed classes put on their plates. As McKinney and Clemente point out, it is the equivalent of rigging an election. And we will add, it bears no relationship to democracy. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Workers' Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. The CWA and IBEW are holding ready-to-walk pickets as labor contract talks continue at Verizon. The unions have set a new deadline of midnight Sunday. The strike clock remains stopped at 11:59 p.m. August 2nd. The unions say progress is being made at the bargaining table, and the talks are being held around the clock in an effort to reach an agreement. Some 70,000 CWA and IBEW members are ready to strike, if necessary, Sunday at midnight.
In California, workers and their unions are fighting back against anti-worker actions by the governor that cut 20,000 state jobs and would slash the wages of 200,000 state workers to the federal minimum wage. The SEIU has filed suit against that move. State Controller John Chang is refusing to comply with the governor's order and says even if he did, it would take months to implement and would trigger more lawsuits. The California Labor Federation's Jeremy Smith says that workers are not to blame for California's budget problems.
We think it's not their fault that the budget crisis is a crisis. We hope that the governor realizes the error in his ways of doing this executive order and rescinds it, works that much harder to make sure that workers in the state don't have to suffer because of his inability to get a budget done.
As the seventh anniversary of 9/11 approaches, a new bill in Congress would guarantee federally funded ongoing health care for 9/11 first responders, cleanup workers, residents, and students in the area of the attack. Robert Spencer is with the World Trade Center Community Labor Coalition.
We have a situation where we have sort of a national disgrace that the federal government has yet to make a firm ongoing sort of commitment to the long-term health needs of those injured by 9/11. And so it's really long past due for Congress and the Bush administration to do the right thing here.
The bill would create centers of excellence to centralize health data and offer ongoing treatment. The nation's largest supplier of kosher meats has allegedly violated child labor laws dozens of times. Jesse Russell reports.
Nearly 60 cases of child labor law violations have been allegedly uncovered at Agriprocessors Kosher Meat Packing Plant in Postville, Iowa. In a statement released on Tuesday, Iowa's Labor Commissioner Dave Neal said the investigation found egregious violations of virtually every aspect of Iowa's child labor laws. In May of this year, 389 illegal immigrants were arrested during a raid on the plant. That raid and months of investigations led to the 57 cases of child labor violations being uncovered. The violations include exceeding allowable work hours, exposure to hazardous chemicals, failure to obtain permits, and more. Neal has called for the violations to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. The company has not commented on the allegations. In Iowa, it is illegal for anyone under the age of 18 to work in a meatpacking plant.
Workers Independent News, we can review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Earlier this month, on the 39th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11, the first spacecraft to carry humans to the surface of the moon, Al Gore proposed a challenge at least as bold as John F. Kennedy's 1961 challenge to land a man on the moon and bring him back safely by the end of the decade. Gore proposed that the United States commit to generating 100% of its electricity renewably and from what he called truly clean carbon-free sources within 10 years. He touted a combination of wind and solar for U.S. electricity needs. Regardless of whether 100% renewable electricity is achievable within 10 years, Gore's challenge is a sort of bold goal that we need at a time when business as usual is leading us off a cliff, economically, environmentally, and security-wise. For me, Gore's challenge is also an excuse to revisit comments I made at the beginning of this year about the possibilities of substituting electricity for oil. At the time, oil had just closed at $100 a barrel for the first time. How much can electricity substitute for oil? There are limits, partly because oil is an energy-dense liquid fuel. You can pour it in your gas tank and carry large amounts of energy long distances. Batteries don't store as much energy in a given weight or a tank size. Your house's oil tank can be filled in the summer and store that oil until cold weather sets in with virtually no loss. Batteries won't do that either. Yet electricity can replace some uses of oil. For now, let's adopt Al Gore's bold vision and imagine 100% renewable generation of electricity within 10 years. Further, let's pretend that we can wave a magic wand and make that supply of electricity unlimited. Given an unlimited supply of electricity, how could we use it to substitute for oil? Only a tiny percentage of electricity in the U.S. is generated using oil, so there's little to be gained by replacing the oil with other fuels. Transportation. Now that's where the big oil uses are in the United States. Cars, trucks, buses, and airplanes account for 2/3 of U.S. oil consumption. Cars are the single biggest users, guzzling about 25% of all the oil we use. Plug-in hybrid cars could replace most of their gas use with electricity. Plug-in hybrids charge their batteries from the electric grid. For shorter trips, the batteries and an electric motor are all that's needed. For longer trips, a gas tank and gasoline engine provide the extra range. For many users, almost all daily trips could be within the range of the batteries, dropping gasoline use to nearly nothing. Other options are completely battery-driven cars, or cars that run on hydrogen made with electricity, from water. All this would take time. Even for technologies that have been successfully demonstrated, like electric cars, it takes time to gear up factories and begin production. Even if all the new cars and light trucks purchased from today onward were plug-in hybrids, it would still take 10 to 15 years to replace half the existing fleet at the rate people buy new vehicles. And, as world oil production declines, the economy is wobbling. In hard economic times, people tend to hold on to what they have rather than buying replacements, so the turnover time is becoming even longer. That's probably why Gore advocates subsidizing car companies to produce and sell plug-in hybrids. Electrifying buses, trolleys, and trains is also possible. These, too, take time and money. In sum, there's only room for marginal short-term replacement of oil with electricity. 2/3 of U.S. oil use is for transportation, and it would take a couple decades to retool our vehicles and our rails so that large amounts of electricity could power cars, buses, and trains. To be fair, Gore's proposal is focused primarily on phasing out coal by the end of the decade, and that would have a tremendous effect in reducing U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases. At a time when world oil exports are dropping, and projected to continue to drop, renewable electricity is not much of a solution for reducing oil dependence. A lot more reduction in oil use will probably come from simply less moving of our bodies and our stuff. As during World War II, people will ask, "Is this trip really necessary?" before going anywhere. We might even discover more of the treasures of our own country and become better friends with our neighbors. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
After years of watching chefs cook and cooking for myself, there are some ingredients I just take for granted and assume everyone else does as well. I was reminded not everyone has had the luxury of learning from chefs the other day when I was waiting on a table and they asked me what shallots were. Surely everyone uses shallots, and if they aren't, they should be. A shallot is a member of the allium or lily family. They grow in clusters and look similar to an onion with an elongated shape and a papery, coppery skin. Shallots have a very mild and complex oniony flavor, and they lend an amazingly subtle flavor to all sorts of preparations. Shallots contain more sugar than onions, and this sugar caramelizes when they are cooked. This makes them a great addition to the traditional start of any savory dish. In restaurants who use classical French techniques, many sauces and savory dishes begin with a trio of onions, garlic, and shallots. Shallots are frequently used in Asian cooking, especially in Thai cuisine, where they are used far more frequently than onions. In many Asian and Indonesian cuisines, fried shallots are used as a garnish to finish dishes. Of course, fried shallots are a delicious garnish for Western dishes, too. Shallots are grown locally, although they can be a bit hard to find. I have seen them in the past at Sipple Family Farm, which sells at the Clintonville Farmers Market. Choose shallots which are firm and heavy for their size. As with onions, they contain a good amount of water, and if they feel light, they are probably desiccated within. They should not have any external blemishes and should not be moldy. Store them in a cool, dark place. Always buy your shallots in bulk. They are far cheaper than prepackaged shallots. Shallots can be used anywhere onions are used, and they make a delicious side dish on their own. I like to cut them in half and sauté them with just a bit of balsamic vinegar. They become delightfully sweet and are great with meat dishes. They also make a nice addition to roasted potatoes. Just toss them with olive oil along with parboiled potatoes and roast for 15 to 20 minutes in a hot oven. Now that I think of it, I can't really think of any vegetable dish which wouldn't benefit from the addition of shallots. The next time you are confronted with a shallot, I hope you will try it. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS, LPFM 102.1 and 98.3, Columbus Community Radio.
Thank you. And now the winner of the Best Central Wisconsin Community Radio Station is voted by us computer voices, WNRB.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for August 2nd through August 8th, 2008. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak stated his belief on Thursday that a peace agreement between Palestinians and Israelis is unlikely by the end of this year. As the Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its seventh week, death toll in Gaza reaches 227. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. We begin our weekly report with recent nonviolent actions in the West Bank. IMEMC's Rola Shahwan has the details.
On Monday morning, Palestinian medical sources in the central West Bank city of Ramallah told IMEMC that 17-year-old Yusuf Amira, who was shot in the nearby Nilain village on Wednesday evening, had been pronounced dead. Amira was among the villagers who took part in the funeral of Ahmed Musa, the 11-year-old Palestinian boy who was killed by the Israeli army gunfire earlier on Tuesday night. As soon as the funeral on Wednesday afternoon was finished, local youth clashed with the Israeli soldiers. Amira was among the three who were injured. On Thursday, a group of peace activists, including internationals and local villagers, marched in a nonviolent protest against the wall at Nilain village near the southern West Bank city of Ramallah. Israeli army soldiers attacked the protesters. During clashes, three protesters were injured by soldiers firing rubber-coated steel bullets and dozens suffered from CS gas inhalation. The Israeli army kidnapped two members from the local popular committee against the wall and settlement construction. The Israeli army dispersed the weekly nonviolent protest located at Bel'in village, north of the West Bank city of Ramallah, on Friday midday with gas, guns, and grenades, local sources reported. After the weekly Friday prayer, a group of 300 internationals and peace activists marched in nonviolent protest in solidarity with the people of Bel'in village. The protest was against the illegal wall being built on the village lands. The protesters were demonstrating against the Israeli killings of local civilians as well as the illegal closures and confiscations of lands and property. The protesters walked toward the wall with the intention of reaching the villagers' land behind it. Israeli troops shot CS gas canisters, rubber-coated steel bullets, and concussion grenades at the protesters. A number of civilians reported suffering from gas inhalation, and for the first time, Israeli troops threw manure at the protesters. A group of 150 nonviolent protesters marched in a protest against the illegal wall on Friday midday at Al-Khadr village nearby the West Bank city of Bethlehem. IMEMC correspondents reported that the protest took place after the Friday prayer at the village. The demonstrators marched in protest against the apartheid wall being built on the village lands. Israeli troops stopped the protest by shooting tear gas and sound bombs at the protesters, causing two civilians to suffer from gas inhalation. Moreover, on Friday, the Israeli army attacked the weekly nonviolent protest at Al-Masara village, southern the West Bank city of Bethlehem. A group of internationals, peace activists, and villagers marched in protest against the illegal wall being built on the village lands. The protesters headed towards the wall. Israeli troops attacked the protesters by shooting grenades, gunfire, and tear gas, causing many to suffer from gas inhalation. For IMEMC.org, this is Rula Shahwan.
Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak stated his belief on Thursday that a peace agreement between Palestinians and Israelis is unlikely by the end of this year. Barak had earlier hinted at the possibility of carrying out a large-scale military offensive on the Gaza Strip. This and more by IMEMC's Kendra Poirier.
Barak's remarks are contrary to outspoken optimism by other Israeli and Palestinian officials over the weekend, as the meeting between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas reiterated the two sides' willingness to hold more talks for the sake of an agreement. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat told reporters on Wednesday following the leaders' meeting in West Jerusalem that the two parties agreed to continue talks over outstanding issues until they reach an accord. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators held a new round of talks in Washington this week in hopes of seeing an agreement on the two-state solution before President George W. Bush's term in office comes to an end in January 2009. Erekat revealed that Israel agreed to release 150 Palestinian prisoners with long-term sentences and chronic diseases. Earlier this week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas held talks with Jordanian King Abdullah II in Amman. The two leaders discussed the need for peace in the region based on the two-state solution envisioned by Washington. Among the contentious issues of negotiations are the continued Israeli settlement activities on occupied Palestinian lands, the status of East Jerusalem, the problem of Palestinian refugees, and the borders of Palestinian state. Israel's drive towards settlement activities might negate the Palestinians' right to a sovereign Palestinian state within the borders of 1967, which includes the entire West Bank region, the occupied East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza slammed the recent Abbas-Olmert meeting as a waste of time only helpful to Israeli Prime Minister Olmert, who is facing corruption charges that would topple him. Hamas, which lies under strict Israeli blockade, also urged President Abbas to restart a stalled dialogue with the Hamas party instead. Earlier this week, rivalry between Hamas and Fatah reached a climax, with Hamas using arms against a Fatah-linked clan in Gaza City and finally forcing more than 150 members of such a family out of Israeli territories. Abbas of Fatah in turn reiterated his demand to Hamas that the party should renounce control over Gaza following the Saturday's clash with Fatah-allied people. Since 2006 parliamentary elections, both Fatah and Hamas have been at loggerheads until the democratically elected Islamic Hamas Party took over Gaza completely and ejected Fatah-loyal security forces in June 2007. Over the past 14 months, Israel has placed the coastal enclave under a strict military blockade and has carried out sporadic attacks on Palestinian resistance groups there involving the governing Hamas. For IMEMC, this is Kendra Purrier.
As the Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its seventh week, the death toll in Gaza Strip reaches 227. This and more from IMEMC's Rami El-Meghari in Gaza.
In the Gaza Strip, the number of patients who have died due to the Israeli siege has reached 227. As one more patient dies this week, medical sources pronounce the death of 53-year-old Suad Abu Rabuh, who died of cancer. She was not able to leave the Gaza Strip to receive life-saving medical treatment. In addition, Palestinian security sources told media outlets that Israeli gunboats fired at fishermen in the Sudaniya area in northern Gaza and in the city of Khan Yunis in the south. No casualties were reported. Since the outbreak of the Al-Aqsa Intifada in September 2000, more than 5,000 Palestinian fishermen have been exposed to nearly constant harassment by Israeli naval forces. Israeli army has continued to close all border crossings of the Gaza Strip for more than 1 year and a half. The total siege imposed by the Israeli army on the Gaza Strip has left disastrous impacts on the humanitarian situation and has violated the economic and social rights of the nearly 1.5 million Palestinian civilian residents, particularly the rights to appropriate living conditions, health and education. Furthermore, severe restrictions have been imposed on the movement of the Palestinian civilian population. The siege imposed on the Gaza Strip has severely impacted the flow of food, medical supplies and other necessities such as fuel, construction materials and raw materials for various economic sectors. Israeli forces have continued to prevent the entry of raw materials into the Gaza Strip, and subsequently manufacturers have stopped their industrial activities. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami El-Meghari in Gaza.
Israeli forces killed a Palestinian civilian in Na'alin village west of Ramallah. In addition, two Palestinian civilians were wounded by the Israeli gunfire. During 38 invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank, Israeli forces kidnapped 49 Palestinians, including three children. IMEMC's William Bascom had the details.
This week's attacks were focused in the cities of Nablus, Hebron, Jenin, and Ramallah. The number of Palestinian civilians kidnapped by the Israeli army in the West Bank since the beginning of the year now stands at 1,718. On Monday morning, Palestinian medical sources in the central West Bank city of Ramallah told IMEMC that 17-year-old Yusuf Amira, who was shot in the nearby Nil'in village on Wednesday evening, had been pronounced dead. Amira was among the villagers who took part in the funeral of Ahmad Musa, the 11-year-old Palestinian boy who was killed by Israeli army gunfire the previous Tuesday night. Following the funeral on Wednesday afternoon, local youth clashed with Israeli soldiers. Amira was among the three who were injured during the clash. Also on Monday, the Israeli army invaded Al-Farah refugee camp south of Tubas. Israeli troops besieged a house belonging to the family of Yusuf Mohammed Sarhan, 27. Soon after, Israeli military vehicles moved into the camp to support the Israeli army. Israeli soldiers called through megaphones for Sarhan and his family to get out. The family followed the orders, which resulted in Israeli troops kidnapping Sarhan. Israeli soldiers then moved into the house and searched it, confiscating two computer sets. On Tuesday, a group of Israeli settlers attacked the West Bank city of Hebron. Eyewitnesses reported that the Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian cars by throwing stones. Settlers also attacked several houses in Wad al-Nasara village in an attempt to break in. Also in the village of Wad al-Nasara, medical sources reported that Israeli settlers attacked 80-year-old Aish al-Jabri, who sustained moderate injuries and bruising. He was transported to a local hospital for treatment. Israeli forces have continued to impose severe restrictions on the movement of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem. During the reporting period, Israeli troops positioned themselves at various military checkpoints in the West Bank and kidnapped four Palestinian civilians. For IMEMC.org, this is William Bascom.
And this is just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report was brought to you by George Shmawi and Hossam Kassis.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends, and some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were three of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison. Oh, the wind is blowing. Through the graves the wind is blowing. Freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from shadow.
Je n'ai pas peur. J'ai repris mon âme. J'ai changé 100 fois de nom. J'ai perdu femme et enfant. Mais j'ai tant d'amis. J'ai la France entière. Dans un grenier, pour la nuit nous a cachés, les Allemands l'ont pris. Il est mort sans surprise.
Oh, the wind is blowing, through the graves the wind is blowing, freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. We've come to the end of this week's abbreviated Mike Cannon Show. The Mike Cannon Show is produced for not-for-profit community and micropower radio use worldwide. Executive producer extraordinaire is David Preckel, with technical and web assistance from Michael Red Fox. Thanks for listening. Gotta run. But remember, until next week and forever, I am always yours in a struggle. Mike Cannon.
This has been Glee Glee Productions, specially made for WNRB, Central Wisconsin Community Radio. I'm Mike Cannon.
Sleep now. It'll hurt less in the morning.